This video is brought to you by Holocasa. Our tool transforms independent local real estate agents to global real estate agents. Create your own profile for free and get contacted by international investors. Sign up with the link in the description. Hello and welcome everyone to our 108th session of Holocasa. My name is Michael and today I'm talking to Jeffrey Holst from Chattanooga again. Jeffrey, you have been on the show, I think it was session 64, 67. It's already 3 years ago. Time flies. When we talked last time, you had around 180 properties already. How have been things with you and how have things evolved?
Yeah, I can't believe it's been 3 years already. I would never have guessed that. It's been good. Went through some personal life changes and stuff, but continue to buy real estate, mostly in the Chattanooga area. I think last time we talked, I had maybe 100 properties in Detroit, Michigan area, and then the rest were in Chattanooga. I still have the 100 or so, maybe it's 120 different residential units up there, but now we're up to about 350 total. So we're at about 200, a little bit over 200 here in Chattanooga. We also bought an industrial building. So I bought a 100,000 square foot industrial building and then a couple of office buildings too in the last couple of years.
Crazy, just crazy, impressive. For the people who have not listened to the previous session 3 years ago, give us a wrap or give us an overview how everything started from your side. You started actually from bankruptcy. We talked about it last time, and started to buy your first property once you had around like 15K cash with a friend, which was 30K, and then you basically rented it out for unbelievably, I think, 400 or 600.
I think it was like $600 back then. Yeah, and we still own that that condo, and then one additional one that we bought a few months after that for a similar price point. We actually just got done renovating them last month and re-rented them at $1,300 a month now. So, wow. And again, we only put when we renovated them maybe like 7 or 8,000. So, you know, we have like less than $40,000 into each one, and they're renting out for pretty good money now. But of course, they're worth a lot more than that now. Like if I were to sell them, I'd probably get, you know, 125, 130,000 for those. And they're very small. These are one bedroom, one bath condos, you know, in a building with a lot of different units in it.
And you did buy them during the crisis of which crisis was it? Which
yeah, 2010 is when we bought those. So it was like right at the bottom of the real estate market coming out of the 08 housing crash. So timing was definitely really good, right? These were probably worth around $100,000 US in 2007. And they went all the way down to $30,000 when we bought them. But it was also because of the type of product that they were really susceptible to a big drop off. A lot of stuff in Michigan went down 20 or 30% at that time. Not very much went down 60 or 70% like these did, which is why we were attracted to them. We're like, this seems like an opportunity. And of course they've been really great. So I can't argue. We've kept them for, I mean, they're the first two properties I bought coming out of bankruptcy. Like you said, you know, it was kind of like we didn't have any other option. We had to buy cheap stuff. And fortunately, that was a really good strategy at the time.
Probably at that time, you were quite, let's say, green with all the respect. You were new to the game, and it was just a leap of faith, and you just were... There was also some luck with it. Let's be honest. Yeah,
definitely. Like, so there's luck, but I mean, it was also taking a chance and taking that opportunity at the time when I could do it. I don't think we covered this last time, but when I was younger than that, so like this is when I was around 30 years old when I first started buying real estate. But when I was like in my teenage years, I used to help one of my dad's friends with his rental property. So I had been interested in the concept for quite a while. And I knew other people that had rental properties, and I'd read, you know, books like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and some more specific things. Like there was a guy who used to sell a CD set that taught you how to buy real estate with no money down on like late night television commercials in America. And his name was Carlton Sheets. And I bought his program. So I had some training, but I had never done anything, right? I didn't have any personal exposure to it. And I knew I needed to do something different after the bankruptcy. You know, for people that didn't hear the whole story, I got leukemia and I thought I was going to die. And that actually pushed me into personal bankruptcy a year or so after that. And when I came out of that, I still didn't know if I was going to have a long life. You know, I thought maybe I'll make it for 5 years or something. And I wanted to figure out a way to produce some income that would continue to produce income for my my then wife. Now ex-wife, so I guess I don't care as much if she gets income from it anymore, although she does because we partnered on it. Like part of the deal was we just split everything down the middle, so stuff that I owned when we separated she still owns a piece of. But
because my question led especially to this idea of which data sources do you use nowadays to evaluate like a good deal. I assume on the one hand sourcing the property, and then on the other hand, like obviously, like an attractive buying price. Probably you use some, I don't know, data analytics tools. Sure. which give you like a good indicator of where is an outlier where you can buy. And then on the other hand, obviously, what is the rental price or the rental market? Is that all, or how can I?
Yeah, that's most of it. So because I buy mostly within 30 miles of Chattanooga, Tennessee, I have a pretty good sense of what's a good deal, right? So I have, you know, sort of institutional market knowledge. And what we've done to create that is every deal that we've looked at for years, we put into a spreadsheet what we thought the rents would be, what we thought the value of it was, you know, what we thought the net operating income for that property would be, and then what we thought it should sell for, even if we didn't buy it. So like, this is what we would offer this. And then we would go back after the fact and look at what it actually sold for. And then we would use that to inform our model and say, okay, why did somebody else pay more than we thought, or why did it sell for less than we thought? Like, how come we didn't buy it then? If it was, so we use that information to create a sort of an internal database. So there's not like a data analytics source that we can use for that. So it's almost like I have my own scorecard of what I think these things are worth. The other thing that we do is, you know, my partner he runs a property management company. So we have access to what other properties in the areas are renting for from his property management perspective. And so we do utilize a lot of that institutional knowledge as well. If we get beyond that, like we bought a building this year in Albertville, Alabama. It's about an hour from here. So it's still pretty close to Chattanooga, but it's a little bit outside of our normal buying range. And what we did there is we talked to local property managers. We actually called other apartment buildings and like asked them like how much it would cost to rent a two-bedroom house, a two-bedroom unit and stuff like that. And like, you know, acting like we were tenants almost, like, you know, basically just call me like, hey, I'm looking for a place. Like, what do you have available? Like, how much does it cost? Stuff like that. And we use that kind of stuff to inform it. And then we also looked at like, what are they actually getting in rent, right? Like, let's look at their actual lease contracts and see what they're at. And most interesting to me is, what are the last couple they signed at, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what do those look like? Because sometimes you have somebody who's lived there for 7 years and they might be at a different rent rate than someone who rented yesterday. It's important to know that, because the more recent rent is probably more likely. And usually the more recent ones are higher, but that isn't actually even always the case, right? So if you're seeing a downward trend in the rents, that's important to know too, because that usually would indicate that the building is declining, like it's just not being maintained well. And so people are, or there's something in the neighborhood that's declining. Mm-hmm. Because overall the trend in the US for the last 15 years has been rents have gone up. And even coming out of the Great Recession, 2008 to 2013, rents didn't go up, but they didn't go down either. You know, like that rent at $600 on that first condo in 2010, in 2013, it was like $650. It didn't go up very much.
Interesting.
You know, for like 5 years, but now it's gone up, you know, quite a bit since then. And more than doubled in the last, you know, 6 years after that. So it's a kind of a situation where you see, if you see declines, that's a really concerning issue. There's something going on. You need to get to the bottom of that.
How has the trend been in Chattanooga price wise? I think like Chattanooga has actually evolved quite a lot during the last, let's say, decade, 5 years. Has it been? Go ahead, please.
Yeah, so I've lived in Chattanooga since 2010. Which is ironic because I started buying in Michigan in 2010, but I moved to Chattanooga, then I started buying in Michigan. But I would say, you know, from 2010 until now, so 13 years or so, we've really seen like consistent population growth and consistent building, such that like what we're really seeing is the building isn't quite keeping up with the population growth. So there's upward pressure on rents and there's constant demand. Even now, with interest rates being a lot higher, the availability of supply on the market is very low. And I mean, of course, that's really good demographically for someone who owns rental properties in the area, which is one of the reasons why we're here, actually. We could be investing elsewhere. In fact, one other thing that happened in the last few years since I was last on your show is I now split my time between here and Puerto Rico. So I spend about 150 to 160 days a year in Puerto Rico now. I do a lot of back and forth. And then I travel in addition to that. Like I just got back from Belize yesterday. So I probably spend about the same amount of time in Puerto Rico as I do Chattanooga. And then the rest is just traveling internationally somewhere. Puerto Rico is another market that's very fascinating to me. I have been tapping into the real estate investor clubs and stuff there and trying to learn that market because I think there's a lot of potential growth there as well. Mm-hmm. There's some really interesting tax things for U.S. citizens in Puerto Rico. Now, I don't take advantage of them because I'm not technically a resident there, so I still pay my taxes here in Tennessee. But that does bring a lot of people to Puerto Rico, and it sort of is causing like kind of a change in the real estate market, a change in the economic condition of the island as a whole. And it's also a beautiful place. So. And COVID actually really had a lot to do with this too. That's another thing that's happened since the last time we talked, right?
Yeah, and I think they also have this Bitcoin Nation, at least they tried to in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, so they have 0% tax on cryptocurrencies.
Yeah.
And the U.S. citizens who live in Puerto Rico, because, you know, it's sort of a affiliated territory of the U.S., right? Like it's unclear what its exact status is, but U.S. citizens who choose to move to Puerto Rico are exempt from federal income tax on any income they earn in Puerto Rico. So if you move to Puerto Rico and you buy a bunch of cryptocurrencies and make money on the cryptos that you have there, all of that's taxed only in Puerto Rico for U.S. citizens. And of course, if their tax is 0%, that means you paid no tax on it. And so it's brought a lot of these cryptocurrency traders to Puerto Rico, which is part of why I spend a lot of time there. I'm not into crypto per se, but the people that are into crypto are interesting and they're doing other interesting stuff and they're working on AI technologies. And I mean, just last month, I met the guy who founded Ancestry.com. You know, they're just interesting people there doing interesting things. And I just feel like there's a lot of opportunity there because of that. So I wanted to learn about that market. Much like when I moved to Chattanooga, it took me several years before I bought anything here. I'm kind of in that same process there now. I've been there off and on for 18 months. I think in, you know, the next year or so, I'll probably start buying some properties there because I think it's a really interesting market. I might change my mind, though. You know, that's the part of the reason you explore this stuff before you buy it is you want to find out what you don't know first. Like you don't want to just jump into something. Oh, that sounds interesting. I'm going to go buy. Like when I was in Belize, some people were telling me about some real estate opportunities in Belize. And I was like, man, that sounds great. And like, part of me wants to be like, let's just buy something here. Like it'd be fun. But there's this other part of me that says, maybe you need to learn a lot more about Belize before you do that. Yeah. And I went through this process in Tanzania last year too, where we almost bought a property in Tanzania. A resort property that was on the edge of a national park so people could go and visit the wildlife and then come back and have a luxury resort experience after being in the out in the bush for a day or two. And I might still do that too, but again, much like Puerto Rico, I needed to learn more, study more before I invested capital in a place like that. And there are different challenges in every place, right? You have to think about the stability of the local government. And Tanzania is a socialist government. So you have to think about how does that work? You can't own land in Tanzania as a foreigner. And it's not like you can just become a Tanzanian citizen because they don't recognize dual citizenship. So you have to revoke all other citizens. So like some places you can just like go buy land and they'll let you own it as long as you agree to be a citizen or something and pay tax to them. But you can't do that there unless you're willing to give up your other citizenship. And I think that would be a bad trade. Like Tanzania's visa free travel is not as not as wide as the United States or like say a European Union passport or something. So I don't think very many people will take them up on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a couple of people from Puerto Rico on Hello Casa, so I can send you the links or the contacts.
Oh yeah, sure. I'd love to see that.
I can definitely put you into contact if you need. Probably you already have like a huge network over there, I believe.
Well, I've been working on it, and you know, there's a REIA organization, Real Estate Investors Association there, and I've been tapped into that a little bit, and actually I'm speaking at their event next week, so I. Hopefully we'll meet some more people next week when I'm back in Puerto Rico. So
this implies that you basically put everything on autopilot regarding your real estate properties, your rentals. And do you have a team? Do you use systems and services? Or is that the partner you mentioned in the beginning who is doing the property management?
Yeah, so I have one partner in Michigan who has a property management company, and he does handle the majority of the day-to-day stuff. Where my involvement is in bringing capital, whether that's raising capital from some outside source or helping get financing or bring our own capital. So I'm involved in that part. And certainly if we're buying new properties or we're in a heavy renovation, then I'm more involved. But once everything is sort of handled, then he takes over and manages it. And we pay him, you know, management fees for that before splitting our profits and stuff. And kind of the same thing in Chattanooga. My partner here, same thing. He also has a property management company. And I think these are great resource. If you can align yourself with an owner of a property management company, it can be really useful, because if you're 50-50 partners with someone, they're going to do the best that they can for that property because it benefits them. And then by extension, it benefits you. And so that's actually allowed me to have a little bit more time freedom when it comes to that. And then, of course, in exchange for that, I do provide some services to them that they might not have the ability to do, like in the capital raising area or even this expansion thing. Like if I buy something in Puerto Rico, one or both of them may very well be involved in that. And I'll have been the one that did the initial research and built the team and found a property manager there for us to work with and all that stuff. So that's the sort of my role has sort of shifted away from the day-to-day operations at this point.
Got it. Makes total sense. Now I'm curious about, you just mentioned that you bought around like this year alone, I think it was 50 or 60 properties.
Yeah.
How do you allow this, let's say, very, very fast process of purchasing? I believe you seriously know exactly. You don't even know to talk or don't even need to talk. You just say, okay, done deal. And then you guys do the rest.
So we bought 56 units this year, but it was one building, right? So it's really one transaction, and we worked on it from the beginning of the year until a few months ago. So, I mean, it was probably about a we started that in December. So it's probably like a 120 day process to buy that property. We also simultaneous to that, we're working on an office building that we bought this year as well. That building took a little bit less time. And because one of my partners had previously rented from the owner of the building, we knew the building really well. So we had we had some flexibility on that one. But yeah, I mean, it's really just about knowing what you're looking for, right? So like we have a buying criteria in Chattanooga that we pretty much only buy, you know, buildings between like 10, maybe 15 units to about 50 or 60 units, and only in certain neighborhoods. And because we're looking for, you know, buildings in a B-class neighborhood, potentially that are a little bit run down, they may be a C-class building in a B-class neighborhood, because then we can fix them up. We like to go in and as people move out, you know, we'll replace the floors with hard surface floors with the stone countertops instead of regular countertops. And we have a color scheme and everything already pre-planned. So we already know exactly what it's going to look like when it's done. You know, the layout might be a little different because we're not going to reconfigure the apartment, but we know that we're going to use this kind of granite and this kind of flooring and this kind of paint. And this is where we're going to buy our windows from. And because of that, we're able to really systematize that process. And our contractors all know that, right? So like when we send a flooring guy over, all he needs to do is measure the floor. And then he knows what it's going to cost to do it because he knows what material we're going to use. He knows, you know, how long it's going to take him to put it in and all that stuff. And so we're able to really have good estimates of what the costs are going to be in advance. Now, this inflation we've experienced since COVID has put a little bit of a wrinkle in that because the costs have changed. But fortunately, rents have gone up at this similar rate. So it's, you know, the one thing about inflation is it sort of re-equalizes itself. And one thing that's good about having debt on property is that the debt isn't subject to inflation. So you actually could use the debt as a hedge against inflation. So if you owe dollars, right, and dollars become relatively less valuable, that's what inflation is, right? The purchasing power of the dollar goes down. And then you're earning more dollars as a result of that because rents go up with inflation, but you only owe so the same dollars as you started with. You're really paying back more expensive dollars with cheaper dollars. And so it sort of works as a hedge. So one thing I decided 3 years ago when the COVID stimulus stuff started coming out in the US was, and interest rates are still very low, I said to my partners, we need to refinance and take as much cash as we can out of our deals because the inflation is more than the cost of borrowing. So we're going to actually net out positive. And that's one of the reasons we were able to buy, you know, a couple hundred units in the last couple of years, because we had pulled cash out and utilized that to buy more assets that have since gone up in value, which kind of proved the point. Like I actually had a goal. I said, I want to borrow $10 million in not last year, but 2021. That was the goal for the year. We didn't quite make it, but we're really close. And any of those collectively. So it wasn't all me, but that $10 million now will get paid back with $10 million that are relatively less valuable. So it's like, you know, it's a net win for us.
So for the non-expert, basically you had already paid properties. They were both basically already paid off. And you said, okay, I'm going to go for another mortgage or I'm going to go for refinancing interest rate.
Yeah, it might be they were paid off, but most of it was stuff where like maybe we've been paying on it for 5 or 10 years. The value had gone up some and the debt had gone down. And then we would say, okay, now we owe, if the building's worth, just to make up numbers, it's worth $2 million. We owe $1 million. And the banks are comfortable loaning us $1.5 million. So we would just go and say, okay, find a new bank. The new bank would loan us $1.5 million. You pay off the million and then you keep $500,000 in cash.
So the bank even does be more financing.
Yeah, on the same property.
Got it. Okay.
Usually it has to be a new bank because old banks don't always like, if you bought it for, you know, $1.5 million and now you want to borrow $1.5 million, they're like, no, I don't want to do that. But if you've added value to it and a new bank can come in and have a new appraisal from a new commercial appraiser, and then they say, oh, this is worth $2 million. Then they feel comfortable loaning $1.5 million with $2 million collateral or whatever. I mean, these are obviously just an example, but that's the kind of concept.
You sometimes encounter any challenges regarding the old banks saying, hey, no, we actually made our calculation on the refinancing. We need basically to go for another round of financing on the mortgage. We didn't do the calculation on that. Like you cannot just switch the bank or you cannot just like purchase it out.
In the United States, at least, most of this stuff is contractually determined at the time you purchase. So they'll put in things like prepayment penalties or like minimum hold periods, stuff like that. So obviously you have to work around that. So like we have one property that has a thing called yield maintenance on it. And yield maintenance essentially says that we expect to make a certain amount of money over the life of the loan. And if we don't make that, then you have to pay us the difference. So if you want to pay it off early, that's fine. But you have to pay you know, this penalty effectively by doing that. So it's going to cost you more if you pay it off today than if you pay it off 5 years from now or whatever.
Makes sense.
And so in that case, if interest rates go up, you get a credit for it. If they go down, then it becomes more expensive to pay it off, because the theory is that if you pay them $1 million, they can go put that $1 million and reinvest it in some other debt. Maybe treasury bonds or something. And the difference between what that you would have paid them and what they get is what you owe them.
Got it.
That's how it's calculated. And in that case, we're not able to, in 2021, refinance that property, even though we have a lot of equity in it, because it had a very big prepayment penalty, like almost $500,000. And the loan's only like $1 million or something like that. And so it just didn't make sense to refinance that one early. But most of our stuff didn't have that in it. So we were able to refinance, sometimes even with the same bank.
Thank you so much. Very interesting about all the financials. And I really always, I'm very also interested in the banking regulations and the financing mortgages. So thanks for those insights. You just mentioned you bought a commercial entity or commercial building.
Sure.
Real estate prices, trends regarding commercial since COVID has been a bit bumpy. What was basically the reason that you went for it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So again, it comes down to like having that market knowledge, right? So my partner here manages a little bit of industrial and some other industrial flex space, which is like office industrial mixed. And so we're pretty comfortable with the rental rates here. And then there was a building that we actually looked at buying 5 years ago. We were able to get it for the same price now as we were 5 years ago, because like you said, it's been a little bit bumpy and people were a little bit scared. So, we bought the building, about a year ago. And it's been performing really, really well. It's got a single tenant triple net in it, and, they pay their rent, you know, like clockwork, and it's been really good. It's got a really good return on it. And, we were able to finance it, you know, at a much lower rate. Now it would be difficult to make that deal work, but we had put in long-term financing a year ago when before rates went up. So
this is definitely where your data set plays in and your experiences, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, it was just like, you know, it's a building we're familiar with, again, in an area we're familiar with. And, you know, and a long-term quality tenant in place already. So, and then also part of it is just having those relationships with the people that have the listings. Cause in this case, the broker that was the selling broker on it, is someone we've bought other things from over the last few years. And he remembered that we had expressed interest in this property years ago, and weren't able to make a deal for a variety of reasons. And so we were able to go back and make the deal this time, you know, because we learned from our previous complications about what the seller was looking for and things like that, and we'll be able to make our offer more attractive to the seller. And you know, it took a little massaging to get it done, but it's, like I said, it's been a really good deal for us. So
I have one more question regarding financing and mortgage interest rates, especially. You just mentioned the interest rate which you got for this one, and you wouldn't have gotten like a bigger one or a more favorable one. Is it the bank? Are the institutions treating you more favorably with all the credibility you have with all the assets? So do you get that? Can basically like a real estate investor expect that he can also lower the interest rate he is being offered?
Yeah. So they do treat us more favorably, but I don't think they can give us, the banking regulations are kind of complicated. So I don't think they can actually give us better rates. So like the new investor might have the same interest rate as us. But where that might be different would be like if they have a program that they're rolling out, and because we have an existing relationship with them, they might have a promotional rate for a certain period of time. They're going to tell us about it. So we're going to hear about it. So we might get an opportunity that might be available to anyone else who asked about it. But if they don't ask, they don't know. And you don't know to ask necessarily. And I don't think that's intentional on the bank's part. It's just like they think, okay, who should we tell about this? Like what of our customers might be interested in this deal that we're running? So we do get a little bit of a benefit there. But I think where the real benefit comes in is they've gone through underwriting already, so we can get things done faster. Like since they know our finances, and we're updating them constantly. It seems like every couple of weeks I have to give them some kind of update or something, right? And this is pretty much year round. So whenever we do want to get something, we can usually have a conversation with our banker and say, what is this going to look like? And they can tell us with a relative amount of certainty whether they can get the deal done and what it will look like, which allows us to then make our offers based on that information. And of course, that means we can make more aggressive offers, we can offer quicker, we can close quicker. And all of those things give us an advantage over someone who maybe isn't already working with that bank.
Makes total sense. With all your knowledge, have you considered starting like your own service for potential real estate investors, people yeah. who want to jump into it? Is there anything, because I believe like you have so much of knowledge, you have so much of expertise. Is there anything from your side?
It's a question of time, right? More than anything. For me to justify spending a lot of time on something, I would have to charge a pretty reasonably large amount of money. And so I have done a little bit of coaching, like one-on-one coaching. Like say you called me up and said, hey, I really want to like learn about whatever it is. And then it's really whether the person that's approaching me is in a situation that I think I can help them with. That's the first thing I look at. Then the second thing I look at is, do I actually want to spend a lot of time with that person? Because if I don't like someone, like I don't think you can pay me enough to spend a bunch of time with them. I don't want to do that. And so the one-on-one stuff though, I do, you know, maybe one or two people a year will hire me for 10 hours or something. And I really enjoy doing it because I can make a big impact in someone's life and I can get to know someone better and get paid for doing it. But, yeah. But I hesitate to do some kind of like program or like group coaching or something because
mastermind
I think in those
group.
Things,
okay. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. I think in those things you run the risk of it becoming like a money grab. So I'd have to really think about how I was structuring that. We have been toying with creating a, me and a couple of other people actually. So it'd be five of us creating a kind of like a networking group coaching kind of thing. But I'm not sure how that's going to look and what it will eventually look like, but I definitely mm-hmm. have thought about it. So people could definitely reach out if they want more information, Instagram or Facebook or something like that. It's just Jeffrey Holst everywhere. That's my website is jeffreyholst.com. So, yeah. And there's information about it on there as well. It's also a good place to get my book, by the way, like if you want to buy my book, although I think Amazon's just as good as anywhere else. But
so tell us about your book.
Yeah. So it's called No Bad Days, How to Make Every Day Great. It's looks like this for people who are watching instead of listening. It's a book that it's my life story. You know, so it takes you from when I was diagnosed with leukemia, actually from even before that, when I was 17 and gave up bad days and made a decision that I was never going to have another bad day again, and sort of how that process worked for me and how I was able to maintain that even in spite of thinking I was going to die and going bankrupt and going through a divorce that I didn't expect, you know, although the divorce isn't in the book because it happened after I wrote it, but all of these things that I've gone through, and all the lessons I learned along the way. So, you know, I'll take you through my life and then the lessons I learned. And then we have some reflection stuff in there as well. And I'm really happy with how it turned out. In fact, it came out last month in April. I guess 2 months ago now in April. And, nice. And it was, the number one bestseller for a little while on, personal finance on Amazon. So wow. That made me really happy. Yeah.
Congratulations.
So I'm a best-selling author now. Amazing. I knew that was coming.
I love it. That's super cool. Jeffrey, thank you so much. I know your time is limited. You have to jump into another call. You just mentioned how people can reach out to you. It's Jeffrey Holst everywhere. And I also leave your contact information in the show notes.
Sure.
Any other final words which you would like to share with the audience?
Yeah, you know, if you're looking at investing right now, be careful because we're in a weird place in the market cycle with all this inflation and interest rates going up. But also don't just wait. Like, I know people that have been waiting for a market correction for 5 years now, and they've been out of the market for 5 years and they missed out on a lot. So I think the thing is, if your deal works now, like if you find a piece of property that makes sense to you now, go ahead and buy it. Because if it works now, it's going to work later. It's unlikely to get worse, right? And so if the market does go down in the future, as long as you don't have to sell that property at a loss, like as long as it's still paying for itself, the rents probably won't go down. The expenses might go up a little bit. You know, we could see that. But if, as long as it doesn't have a loss and you don't have to sell, eventually it'll be fine. You know, if you bought a property for $200,000 today and it's only worth $150,000 tomorrow, but 10 years from now it's worth $250,000. It doesn't matter that it was worth $150,000 tomorrow if you sell it for $250,000 10 years from now. The only matters when you sell. So don't get too stressed about where we are in the market. Just buy things that work and stick to the fundamentals.
Sounds good. So more micro and less macroeconomic and less macro picture. Thank you so much, Jeffrey. I really learned again so many things. I really appreciate that we went into all the finances and mortgages and financing. I'm still very weak on actually this part. So appreciate also your time on guiding me a little bit through that.
Sure.
I really appreciate that you also talked about like the Chattanooga area. How have you started all your knowledge, all your expertise? Quick detour to the commercial side, and again, very impressive what you have achieved so far. And I'm sending you best regards. Obviously, that you stay healthy and that you keep going to Puerto Rico and to Belize.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. So when plan. I come back in 3 years, we'll talk about all the stuff I bought in Puerto Rico.
Exactly. But let me know. Don't just buy and maybe if you have like some good investment opportunities, you can also like pass me one along.
Oh yeah, sure. For sure I will.
Cool. Have a good one, Jeffrey, and have a nice afternoon. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.